Welcome to the BPC Women's Ministry Teams podcast. These episodes were created to complement small group discussions about the book Confronting Christianity by Rebecca McLaughlin. Today's episode is Chapter 4.
Hello, I'm Claire.
And I'm Jess.
And welcome to our podcast. This week we're doing Chapter 4. On Doesn't Religion Hinder Morality? Now, this chapter isn't going to be covered in our book clubs. It's one of the ones we're not actually going to be discussing in our groups. But what it covers is that the claim that religion makes people less moral, so not actually more, and that religion just gives people some divine justification for evil and their immoral behavior. Now, Jess, I'm sure you've heard a few in your time, but what is one of the funniest justifications you've heard of for a dumb decision?
Okay, a justification for a dumb decision. One of the first ones that come to mind is, I shouldn't laugh, is I knew a guy who used to make most of his life decisions based on birds. Bear with me.
Okay.
there were good birds and bad birds, and, you know, if they appeared at certain times, it meant that the decision was good or bad. This is a wow. real person. So at one point he left his job because out his window was a bad bird.
Left his job.
Yeah, he just quit. He was like, no, clearly this is a bad sign. I can't work here. There's a bad bird out the window. And, you know, there were other decisions. And I think where it got really sad was he actually left his family over one of these bird incidents. You know, he had a wife and two kids. And there were birds in the backyard, and then there were more birds in the backyard, and then there were more birds in the backyard. And he took that as a real doomsday sign, and he just up and left his family, and he Wow. left his kids, and he left his wife, and he moved and started a new life. And I just looked at that and I went, oh my gosh, that is a really silly justification for a dumb decision.
Yeah. Big life-changing decision.
Yeah, because of birds. And in my head, I'm like, you know, did you have fruit trees? That would that would mean that birds were coming. You know, did you throw seed? Like, there's so many
reasons
why that could have been the case. Mm. And it was not worth making a life decision that hurts people over. Mm. Anyway, so that's one of the stories that comes to mind about dumb decisions and not good justification.
It is. That's a pretty big, justification for things that could have many variables associated to it.
Mm.
In this chapter, we cover a lot of things to do with morality and people's reasoning or justifications for doing things. Do you want to share with us a bit about what you've discovered as you've been reading through this chapter?
Sure. So I'll do a summary for those who haven't read the book.
Mm-hmm.
So this chapter, again, is talking about the argument that religion actually makes people do really evil things, and they get a blanket pass because it's for religion or it's for God, and they think it's justified. So I think most of us can think of examples of religion leading people to do really evil things. You know, suicide bombers come to mind. But Rebecca actually starts the chapter with saying there's three problems with that claim.
Mm-hmm.
Firstly, it lacks in, if I can say this word, specificity.
Yes.
Specificity.
Yes.
So not all religions are the same. So we can't make big sweeping claims about all of them. You know, there's very little similarities between Buddhist meditation and ISIS terrorism. That's as far away from each other as you can get.
Yes.
So we can't just make this big claim that, you know, all religions lead to, you know, worse morality because, you know, you can't make claims about all religions. About anything, something like this.
Say, if even like the whole Catholic priest immorality around them, you can't link that and say that that means all Christianity is all linked to that form of morality.
Yeah, or all churches aren't out to protect children or something like that.
Yes.
So the second point that she makes is that the data actually just doesn't back up that claim. Mm. And I love this point because I'm trained in psych, data, speak to me, research. It's all great to say things, but actually do we have the proof behind it? And she talked about the fact that there's hundreds of studies all around the world that have actually found that vast amounts of people who are involved in religion actually do morally good acts as opposed to yes. their counterpart communities that aren't involved in religions. Mm. So some of the stats that I found really interesting was the levels of domestic violence in the US are twice as high for men who aren't regular churchgoers. Mm. So that's not actually saying what church or what religion, but if you have a faith and if you practice that by going and meeting with people who are like-minded, then actually your family home is safer. Mm. Regular service attenders, so again, those people who go to a church regardless of what that church is, they donated 3.5 times the amount that their non-religious counterparts gave, and they volunteered twice as much. So if you think about all of the places in society that require volunteers, more than half are actually people who believe in a faith and believe in something greater than themselves. I know even in my own circle of friends, like my non-Christian friends, they're lovely. None of them are actively trying to do immoral things, obviously. And yet the ones who are giving the most of themselves, the ones who are saying yes to things that cost them something, whether it be financially or time or energy, the ones who are doing inconvenient things for the sake of others, they're the ones actually who have a faith that's important to them, regardless of what that faith is. Yep. Obviously, Rebecca makes the point that there are, of course, non-religious people who do these things as yes. well, but it's actually most common in religious communities. So the data is clearly saying that religious people and people who take their faith seriously do not, on average, do more immoral things.
Do you know what's interesting that even the Australian government has recognised this fact previous years? So things like that came in the Howard government and even in the Rudd government, so even different parties, some of their policies around supporting theological education and the funding that goes in around that is based on the fact that they see churches, particularly Christian churches, being a positive impact on the morality of society, which I find very fascinating. Yeah. But they've obviously got data that represents that and so are willing to actually fund that to support morality in our society.
Yeah, absolutely. And Rebecca talks about, she mentions it in this chapter, but she goes on in more detail in other chapters. You know, the first hospitals were started by Christians. Yeah. The first universities were started by Christians. Mm. The first schools for children, you know, let's educate the young children. They were started by Christians. Mm. We have a long, long history of doing good things for others.
Yes, yeah.
And rightly so. If we're following Jesus, that's what our life should look like. Called. It shouldn't be a shocker. Yes. The third point that Rebecca makes about why we can't claim that religion hinders morality is that that accusation is actually founded on an assumption that there is an objective measure of morality that all of us intrinsically know and agree to. Mm. And actually, if you take religion away, that's not true. You know, we might say, and I don't think I have anyone in my circles who would say murder is not wrong. You know, we've all got this moral compass of, oh, no, murder is definitely wrong. You go overseas or you go to a different religion or a different community and actually they don't believe that. You know, suicide bombers' families are praised and supported and given money in some ISIS territories because, you know, the actions of their family member who blew up people and killed people is seen as a good thing.
Yeah.
So clearly, and they believe just as strongly as we do, but on the opposite end of the spectrum. So clearly there is no objective, you know, intrinsic, everyone believes the same thing measure.
Yes.
And when we come in with statements like
religion
hinders morality, we are relying on this objective measure that is actually just not shared by everybody.
Yes.
Lots of us think that morality is just known, like known to us, like regardless of your religion, you just know what's right and wrong. But Rebecca says that's actually not the case. And she talks about the origins of human rights actually being Christian. She draws attention to the fact that they actually aren't self-evident. Looking at history, there was thousands of years where if you were strong and powerful and a man, you were worth something. If you weren't those things, you were disposable, you weren't valuable. Even in Jesus's time, you know, women and children were property. You could just give them away. You could swap them. You could discard them. You know, people with disabilities had no value. They were just, like, they were just useless. They
yeah,
were,
you use
they
them
were,
for your own good, and then yeah, if they weren't useful, then you got
they were just
rid of them.
Disposable.
Yeah, yeah.
And into that scene, Rebecca talks about Jesus comes in, and he is just revolutionary. He loves the women. He loves the children. He treats them with dignity and respect and love, and it's just mind-blowing. So actually, human, you know, seeing women and children and all people as having intrinsic value is not just a self-evident thing. That did not happen for thousands of years when humanity was just left, you know, to come up with its own laws about humanity. Actually, Jesus comes in and says, no, these people are valuable regardless of what you deem their value to be.
That's actually one of the things that really stood out to me, the image that Rebecca creates. I think it's on the page 63 for those who are reading. It says, into this world stepped a first century Jewish rabbi who elevated women, valued children, loved the poor and embraced the sick. The early Christian insistence on brotherhood across racial and ethnic boundaries, even across the dichotomy of slave and free, became a spark to ignite a new moral imagination. And values that many of us in the West today consider to be universal and independent of religious thought turn out not to have sprung from the ground during the Enlightenment, but to have grown from the gradual spread and influence of Christian beliefs. It's actually Jesus, like, as you were explaining, that he was, like, pretty revolutionary in that culture, but was actually setting this foundation of what morality and equality should look like.
Absolutely, yeah. And Rebecca talks about how, like, human rights and human value can't be evolutionary either, because actually it's really inconvenient. Evolution is about getting rid of things that you don't need. And it is really inconvenient and a hassle to place value on people who are hard work or who are different from you or who are vulnerable or who are in need of help or protecting. It is inconvenient to hold them as valuable. It'd be easier as a society if we just didn't care and we said, oh, well, they don't matter.
Yeah.
If you can't serve me, then you don't matter.
Yeah.
So actually it can't be evolutionary either, because it actually is the opposite of what evolution is geared towards, which is getting rid of what you don't need. So then Rebecca moves into, some good questions like, why are people valuable? Why should the disadvantaged be cared for? And actually we have no foundation of the value of life without Christianity, which I just thought, I was like, yes, that put words to something that I've actually really noticed. And we can see the inconsistency that atheism has when it comes to morality. Rebecca says atheism can't ground morality. If anything goes, if I can argue it, there's no objective measure for me to hold as a standard, and there's no boss, clearly, because I don't believe in God. So actually what I deem right is right, and what I deem wrong is wrong. And I was thinking about just the inconsistencies, again, trying to land it in, you know, our society and our time. Where do I see these inconsistencies? And it made me think of, like, cancel culture, like the hate and intolerance we have of people, because, and let me get this right, because it is inconsistent.
Yeah.
So we believe that people are valuable and worthy and you have to love and respect them, and that's morally good. But then if we come across someone who doesn't think like that and doesn't think that they are valuable and worthy and you have to love and respect them, then we're allowed to hate and disrespect them and see them as unvaluable, but that is also morally good because now we're standing up for something. So, like, which is it? Are people valuable regardless of what they do, or actually are we only allowed to value people if they agree with us, but then we change our minds and, like, you know what I mean? Like, the inconsistency, and you very quickly get to double standards where you go, you know, you have to support me because I'm intrinsically valuable, but then if you annoy me, I can treat you like you're not intrinsically valuable. Because actually, if there's no objective measure and there's no God, I'm allowed to deem you worthy of respect or not.
Yes. So it's a double standard in what they're viewing.
Yes. And both and completely opposite actions can be seen as good.
Yes.
You know, so it's morally good to love someone, but it's also morally good to cancel and hate them if they've done something that you deem wrong.
That almost comes across like, as you were saying before, atheism, it's up to you what you perceive as right or wrong. Like, you're saying you've got the choice, which almost is putting you in the God seat.
Totally.
Right?
Like, yeah, which is...
In that point.
Yeah, which is what atheism does. Yeah, right? There is no God, so I'll be it.
Yeah, but even that point of deciding, well, this is what is morally correct to this point, but...
Yes. But I deem the right to change it. And how... And I you know, I know no atheists would agree with this, but that is very, very similar then to, you know, ISIS saying, well, it's morally good. Yes. It's morally good to blow you up. Yeah. It's morally good to torture and rape people. It's more, you know, because actually if we're all allowed to decide what's good and what's bad based on our own convenience or belief or standard... Well, then we're all allowed to decide.
Yes.
You can't say, well, I'm allowed to decide because it's me, but you're not allowed to because it's you.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
So, like, atheism, which is Rebecca's point, it actually has no argument for morality. At some point, you come across, yeah, but who gets to decide?
Mm.
And if it's you, we've got a problem.
Yes. And then it falls down on human rights and human equality on every level.
Yes, which we would like to say is universal, but it's actually not.
Yes.
You know, how blessed are we to live in a country that does have human rights and does say, yes, this is not questionable.
Yes.
But that is not the case around the world.
Mm.
Rebecca also talks about how, I was going to read this quote on page 65 for those who are reading, and it's by a Princeton professor, not Cambridge, Princeton this time.
We've moved across another continent.
I'm still waiting to hear something about the New South Wales.
Yeah, that's right.
Sydney Uni. Anyway, Peter Singer, who is a professor and philosopher, he's an atheist, and he was talking about the kind of rationale of who gets rights. And listen to this. So this is a professional, educated man who is respected, and he says this: value should be decided according to the capacities of self-awareness, ability to suffer, and so on. A weak old baby is not a rational and self-conscious being. And there are many non-human animals whose rationality and self-consciousness and awareness and capacity exceed that of a human baby a week or a month old. And therefore, the life of a newborn baby is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee.
Mm.
And that just blew my mind that someone would think that, and genuinely believe it, and then write books about it. You know, we are in such a dark place if there is no standard for good or evil, and if humans actually are just a bunch of cells and there is no intrinsic value to them. Rebecca talks a lot more about that in chapter 7, so we'll chat about that when we get there. But she does just mention, to finish the chapter, the fact that the Christian worldview does give us a solid foundation. It says we are created by a creator. We have value, but we're also called to live in a certain way by the one who actually knows best.
Yes.
So I thought that was a good way to end, to go, yeah, you know what? If there is no God, then free for all, everything goes, you know. But thankfully there is a God, and therefore his standard of right or wrong stands, not ours.
Yes.
So, Claire, thinking about all these things, what kind of questions do you think we could ask our friends about this topic, and how do we actually get morality into the topic of conversation? Because like I was reading this going, yes, I agree. I can't remember the last time I was in the lunchroom talking about morality. And yet I wonder whether it's actually on us to bring it into conversation, because a lot of people are walking around with a worldview that actually falls down, as we've discussed.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if this is what your talking about, but I've actually had some conversations. We wouldn't probably bring up the word morality with some of my friends who've got younger kids, and we often are reflecting on what do we want to see or hear about in terms of how our kids are going at school. Is it how well they're doing in terms of their education, how well they're doing in terms of their school grades, or is it we actually want to see them reflected in being kind to other kids and being respectful, which a lot of them I'm noticing is more of a trend to that, like to thinking about are they being kind and loving, which I thought is an interesting thing because that's something that we as Tristan and I try and instill in our kids, and that's what's most important to us when we're thinking about,
like, if we're trying to be like Jesus, then Jesus was kind and loving, and we want our kids to be like that.
And compassionate and inclusive and respectful.
But why do we want those things of our kids if we don't?
If we don't, so be like Jesus. So it's my friends who are would be considered atheists or at least agnostic. Are still holding those as high standards for, or, you know, as good things for their kids, which is really interesting and is a lovely feature. But my question is, why do these people consider that as an important thing for their kids? What are they basing that on? And why do they hold that as a attribute to be having for their kids?
Yeah, and how would you actually ask them about that, do you think?
That's a good question, because I've had that. I was actually reflecting on that as I was reading through this chapter, and I was thinking I've had those conversations and I would agree with them. So that's the point at which I've gone, yes, that's a good thing to have. But maybe even just simply asking the why, like, why do you think that it is good for your children to hold, like, and beyond, I suppose, human equality or human rights, why do they hold that that is a good human right? Yeah. Where does that come from?
Yeah.
Why do we think equality is a good thing?
Yeah.
I think for many of them, they may not have actually thought beyond that.
Yes.
But maybe that's the questions we need to be asking, the why.
Yeah.
Why do you think?
Yeah, and then coming with, you know why I want these things, because I'm actually trying to raise my kids to look like Jesus.
Look like Jesus, yes.
And Jesus was these things. I'm wondering what your motivation is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is then opening up, isn't it, just such a great opportunity to even share who Jesus is and who this person is that you're modelling your life on.
Yeah.
Have you had any specific
examples? I was thinking, yeah, a bit like you, like, we don't use the word morality, but I wonder if I'm missing opportunities because I'm thinking they have to use the word for me to kind of get an in. But if I open my eyes a little bit more. Some of the people in my circles and myself as well, we get annoyed is probably the word. I was trying to vanilla it down, but no, we get annoyed.
Yeah.
We get annoyed when people are so passionate about the environment and not using plastic and at the cost of not caring about people. So totally fine with looking after the planet. I think God asked us to rule over and to look after the earth that he gave us. And that is a way of loving our neighbour, to look after the world that we have. But when people are so passionate about, you know, there was this one of my friends had a Christmas dinner just a couple of months ago. And one of their family members went off, like, yelling completely, because the crackers that they had brought, the Christmas crackers, weren't recyclable.
Oh.
And the whole Christmas dinner gets tainted by
their
view on plastic and not being recyclable. And I just thought, you know, there's a line in a Casting Crowns song, we save the trees but kill the children.
Yeah.
Like, it's such misplaced passion if the only thing we care about is the world, like the physical world, but we don't believe that we need to protect the vulnerable, whether it's unborn babies or people with disability or the aged population. You know, once you can't do anything for me, I'm happy for you to not be here anymore. There's no passion for looking after them. And I just, you know, so thinking maybe about how I would engage in that conversation with my friends. You know, we all share that outrage, but maybe asking, well, I know why I think human life is valuable over the trees, because I think God created a good creation, but then he created a very good humanity.
Yes.
So God has given me the hierarchy of priority in those two. But I wonder why they think that. You know, why does it does it seem wrong to you to not put that hierarchy in place? And again, maybe that's just getting them to think about it and wondering where that, you know,
priority
where that
comes from.
Yeah. The chapter starts with a really horrible story about how some religions allow atrocious acts in the name of morality. And we only need to watch the news to see that people do very wrong things in the name of God. And it's just really good to remember that that breaks God's heart too. You know, he is so angry and sad when he sees his name being misrepresented. And to see his precious sons and daughters that he made to have relationship with him get it so wrong. But I was also thinking that actually it's really easy for me to look at kind of the big examples of morally wrongness, you know, like murder and stealing and blah, blah, blah. And I go, oh my gosh, they do such a terrible job at, you know, showing that objective morality is a good thing. No wonder people look at ISIS and say, you know, doesn't religion hinder morality? But I was also wondering, like, how often I break God's moral code as well. How often, you know, I'm just a terrible representation of him as well. Sure, I don't do those things, but, you know, I might gossip or I might be selfish or, you know, I let my critical nature just tear other people down when they're just trying to do what they can do. I think, you know, we need to be just as heartbroken when we are bad representations of God. And if I'm going to say to my atheist friends, no, there is a moral right and wrong, and I don't get to decide, God actually decided, then actually I better live like that. I better say, no, God says, you know, gossip is wrong. It's not suddenly okay just because I do it. Or, you know, God says you need to die to self and put others first, but not when I'm tired or when I'm busy. Because that's exactly what we're talking about, you know, that double standard, that saying, well, we all agree this is a good thing, but in special circumstances it changes. So I just need to make sure that I'm actually a good representation of that too.
Yes, and that level of morality, like you said, we might be thinking, oh, well, I am morally upright because I don't steal, I don't murder, I don't, I'm not violent, I'm not...
But that's mostly, as Rebecca says, because of convenience.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
You know, put me in a starving situation and I may steal.
I may do that. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Or I may be violent to someone else in order to get what I need to get. But yes, to be holding up all the moral foundations that Jesus has set before us, which is going to include, yeah, like exactly what you've said, things like gossip or lying to benefit ourselves. And to be reminded that morality is actually based on the foundations that Jesus has set for us. That is where we're getting our moral standards from.
Yeah. And thank you, God, for grace
when
we fail it.
Holy and Heavenly Father, we praise you for who you are and how you have revealed yourself to us through Jesus. Thank you that we do not have a faith that is without reason or logic. And thank you for the brilliant minds that have gone before us to help us better know and defend this faith. We long for you to come back and put an end to all sin and pain. But until that day arrives, help us to be striving to introduce more people to the kingdom. We know you long for none to perish, and you love our friends and family and communities even more than we do. Please save them, Lord, through our feeble efforts and your endless mercy. As we go forth into the day and week ahead, open our eyes to opportunities to spread the gospel. Help us always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that we have. Help us answer with gentleness and respect, and to be living a life that reflects you well.